Hello and welcome to Subject to Change with me, Russell Hogg. My guest today is Hampton Sides. Hampton is an American historian, author and journalist. He has written a number of best-selling books of narrative history, and indeed he has been on the podcast before to talk about one of the key battles of the Korean War. But today we're going to talk about his latest book, The Wide, Wide Sea, which tells the story of the third and last voyage of Captain James Cook, which set sail from England in the summer of 1776. So welcome back, Hampton, to the podcast.
Great to be with you.
So I wasn't quite sure where to start this. I mean, there's just so much to talk about. And by the way, I just wanted to say this is an absolutely wonderful book. The story itself is always moving to a rather shocking climax, but along the way, there's just so much to explore, and there's so many other stories which you tell taking place alongside that of Cook himself, and not least trying to work out how we feel about it all, both looking back with today's morality and also trying to put ourselves in the shoes of the people involved, and both Cook and his men on the one hand, and the indigenous peoples of the islands on the other hand. So I thought I'd start somewhere maybe a bit counterintuitive, which is an event that in a way had nothing to do with Captain Cook, but rather had to do with the fate that befell some men of the ship Adventure at Grass Cove in New Zealand in December of 1773. And the Adventure was a ship that accompanied Cook on his second voyage. But at the time of the events, it had become separated from Cook. So could you just tell us a story of what actually happened at Grass Cove?
Yes. Throughout the annals of exploration literature, there's a lot of accounts, rumors, often exaggerated stories about cannibalism in the South Seas. But this was actually one of those accounts that was true. It really happened. And it happened to Cook's consort ship, the Adventure. A similar ship to Cook's Resolution became separated in a storm. And the captain, Captain Tobias Furneaux, went to a designated spot, this place called Ship Cove in Queen Charlotte Sound on the South Island of New Zealand, and hoping to find Cook. It was one of the rendezvous places they had established. And the local Maori were friendly at first, and everything seemed to be going fine. But near the end, Furneaux sent some of his men out to cut some grass for his animals on board the ship. And they went and found the grass and cut it and began to assemble it. And an altercation erupted between the local Maori and these 10 men on this grass-cutting detail. And things escalated very fast. And these 10 men were killed, they were butchered, and they were eaten in a ceremony. There was a long-standing tradition, Maori tradition, of consuming your enemy, in those who kill you may have killed in battle, to sort of imbibe their spirit, imbibe their mana, as they call it. The reason Captain Furneaux knows this was all true is because he sent a second detail out to the Grass Cove area to find these men who had never shown back up at the ship. And they saw the body parts. They identified heads and hands and understood that these various organs were those of their countrymen. And it was a shocking thing. Obviously, it was one of those taboos that was still discussed back in England as something you don't do. You don't eat, you don't eat a fellow human being. It's just not done. It wasn't so much that these men were killed that shocked and outraged Furneaux. It was that they were eaten. So flash forward, 4 years? And we get to the sort of second part of the tale.
So as I understand it, one of the reasons Cook is on this third voyage is that he wants to understand why this happened, how it happened. I mean, he knows it did happen, but he wants to investigate. And I thought it was very interesting reading your book, the way he went about it. And so could you just explain how he sort of approached the problem?
Yeah. So They make various stops along the way during this third voyage, and one of them is to go right back to the scene of the crime, Grass Cove in Queen Charlotte Sound, New Zealand. Captain Cook wears a lot of different hats during his voyages. Sometimes he's an anthropologist, sometimes he's a map maker, sometimes he's a, you know, ship economist, and sometimes he's frankly a disciplinarian. But on this occasion, he becomes essentially a homicide detective. He wants to go back to the scene of the crime to figure out what exactly happened, to figure out who was at fault, to figure out what should be done about it. And even though it's a justice delayed something like 4 years, he decides it's time to do that. So he goes back, he goes and interviews people, takes notes. He's kind of like, you know, Columbo or one of these detectives. He's very dispassionate in the way he gathers the information. He is not outraged by the cannibalism aspect of it at all. He's like, well, that's just what they do in this culture. Once you're killed, what difference does it make what happens to the flesh once it's been dismembered and hacked to pieces? That's beside the point. And he ultimately decides that this was an altercation. This had been an altercation that was mostly the British fault, that they had too quickly used their muskets, and that the Maori were completely justified in killing these 10 men. Cook even met the man who claimed to be the ringleader of this incident, a man named Kahura. And he essentially gave Kahura a reprieve. Kahura thought, oh, I'm dead now for sure. They're going to retaliate. They're going to kill me. And when it became obvious that he wasn't going to be killed, he became quite arrogant and haughty about the whole thing. So it's a very interesting meshing of cultures here. Now, meanwhile, the British men and some of the officers under Cook are outraged with Cook for being so lenient. They wanted him to not only kill Kahura, but perhaps kill many more men in retaliation for this crime, even though it's a delayed crime or a delayed justice. So Cook's men are mad at him, and the Kahura's people, the Maori, were just extremely puzzled. They didn't understand. Like, in their society, there's a demand for some sort of equilibrium, some sort of, you know, every act requires a counteract to make everything right in the world. And here's this captain not doing anything about it.
So maybe we go back to where I was thinking of starting. So what kind of man is Cook? Where does he come from? What's his background?
So the book is by no means a hagiography of Cook, or even a biography of Cook, although it has a very strong biographical thread running through it, of course. But to that extent, I really did have to learn about his background and his upbringing and so forth. And there are just so many things about him that I have to say that I admire. One of the things that I love about him is that he came from poverty. He came from virtually nothing. He worked his way up through the merchant marine and then through the navy by sheer intelligence, hard work, and just a fierce work ethic. His father was a farmer in Yorkshire, and his life would have been probably, if he had not become so captivated by the sea, his life probably would have been the same kind of life as a farmer or a farm manager in the moors of Yorkshire. But instead, he was drawn to the sea, and he trained under a bunch of Quakers in Whitby. And these were Quaker shipbuilders, and they ran various shipping concerns, mainly ferrying coal from Newcastle down to London. And over a period of about 10 years, Cook really became a master of this work. He traveled all over the Baltic. He traveled all over the North Sea, and he mastered the trade, figured out how to be a captain. And then somewhere along the line, he just decided, I don't want to do this anymore. I want to be in the Royal Navy. And he, in order to do that, he had to take a huge demotion and really become an able seaman again in the Royal Navy. But again, once again, he works his way up through sheer intellect, also through what became quite apparent that he had a mastery of mathematics, trigonometry, geometry, and especially astronomy. And these skills led to his expertise in map making, and his career takes off in Canada during the Seven Years' War. And he just rises. It has kind of a meteoric rise within the Royal Navy.
It is incredible. The Georgian Navy, it helps if you've got connections. It helps if you've got background. But you can't get on unless you're capable. You just can't do it, right?
Well, they certainly valued competence and sheer hard work and discipline, which he had all of those in spades. He didn't have connections. It would have helped him probably to have some better connections, or you know, a lot of officers in the Royal Navy that make it up to a captain have some money or some connections to money. But he was fiercely competent in so many different areas of skill that he was eventually given this plum assignment of going on what became his first voyage around the world on the Endeavour. The famous voyage of the Endeavour with Joseph Banks on board, the famous botanist. They went all over the world, just explored the east coast of Australia, went to Tahiti, went to New Zealand. That was his first voyage, and it was a huge success. And it, of course, then led to a second voyage, and then finally the third voyage, which is the subject of the book.
And do you think, as an American, that you've got some sort of special insight or some kind of a blind spot regarding Cook and the Royal Navy? Is there something to do with being an American and writing this story? Or,
well, I do think I have one advantage as an American, which is that here in America, we don't know anything about Captain Cook. Most people think you're talking about Captain Hook, the pirate. I'm serious. Most of my American colleagues and friends are like, well, you're writing about that pirate guy with, you know, the parrot on his shoulder and the peg leg and the hook. I was like, no. Although some people, perhaps in Polynesia, think of him as a pirate, he was not a pirate. He was one of the greatest explorers of all time. And that's what advantage that might give me is that I don't come at this subject with any preconceived notions. We didn't really study him in school. A lot of people in Australia and New Zealand have a very complicated thing of viewing him as almost a founding father of their country, and yet he's also very controversial. That's sort of like our George Washington. So I don't have any of that baggage at all. And I don't know the English view of him. I'm sure has evolved over time, but it's, I'm sure he studied in school and very much admired. He used to be admired as a hero. Now he's, I think, viewed as a little more complicated cat. But I do think that gives me a little bit of objectivity. Most of the people who have written about Cook, and gosh, the literature on Cook is voluminous, and you know, my shelves are sagging from all the books I've got. But most of the people who've written about him tend to be Australian, or they're New Zealanders, or they're English. So not that many Americans have taken a crack at this guy. The other factor in all this, Russell, is that this third voyage is a very American story. It's a British captain. It's a British voyage, but it happens during the American Revolution, and much of the action transpires on U.S. soil, what is now U.S. soil. I'm talking about Hawaii, Oregon, Washington State, and especially Alaska, which was the goal of this whole expedition, was to go up to Alaska and prosecute this search for the fabled Northwest Passage, but to do it from the Pacific side of the ocean. Cook is so often associated with the South Seas and beautiful Polynesian people, but people also forget he spent a lot of time in the Arctic. And a lot of this book and a lot of this voyage is about his time in the Arctic, trying to find this passage, mapping the entire coastline of Alaska, and nearly getting stuck in the ice along the way.
I was very interested in that part of it, partly because I just tell the listeners, Hampton has written a book called In the Kingdom of the Ice, and I cannot recommend it highly enough. This is the story of a journey of the Jeannette, the expedition of the Jeannette. So that's terrific. So I thought that was a very interesting connection. But but also the British have been trying to find their way, and they carry on trying to find their way after Cook round the north of Canada for, I don't know when it started, in the 1600s, I think. They're absolutely obsessed with it. Can you tell us why they're so interested in this passage? Yes. Is it just for learning, or what's going on?
Well, a big part of it had to do with commerce, of course. The British were looking for a shortcut over Canada to get to the Pacific in order to get to China, to trade with China. It would cut off an enormous amount of time and danger and risk of going around the underside of South America, or going around Cape of Good Hope, around South Africa. They also wanted to avoid the Spanish, who claimed all those waters around South America. Rather absurd claim. They claimed the entire Pacific Ocean, they said, was their property. You can't go there. But anyway, the British wanted to avoid the Spanish and conflicts with the Spanish. That was part of it. But yes, as they got drawn into this search for the Northwest Passage, I think it became more and more of a kind of scientific obsession, and a kind of way of honoring the men who had suffered and died in prior generations. It was like, well, that many people, that much national treasure, blood, sweat, and tears have been expended. We can't let those people have died in vain. We got to keep finding, looking for it. We got to keep looking for it. It's there somewhere. And of course, it is there. We all know there is a way over Canada. It was just that it was impractical. It was locked in ice most of the year. It still is largely locked in ice, although now, of course, today there are months in the summer where you can make it across, certainly if you have a reinforced vessel. So unfortunately, you ended up with the Franklin expedition, all these other expeditions such tragic loss of life, looking for this holy grail, the Northwest Passage.
And Cook, his ship is not reinforced against ice, right? So he's actually in some considerable peril as he tries to push up, and it's late in the season. And I guess he's determined, and presumably his men are slightly anxious, I'm assuming.
Yes. So Cook makes it up through the Bering Strait and up and over Alaska. He's well on his way to a place that we now call Point Barrow, Alaska, which is like the northernmost part of Alaska. So he's making very good time and having a really good experience. He's getting quite hopeful. Like, maybe we're going to get to the Atlantic Ocean and we'll be home soon to be with our wives and loved ones and get our prizes for having found this thing. When suddenly they encounter this impenetrable wall of ice, that's just huge amounts of pressure and, pressure ridges, and it's like 10 feet tall, and there's just no way that they're going to get through it. Not only are they not going to get through it, but it's closing in on them. And he starts to realize, we're going to get stuck in this ice, and we're all going to die. It's a genuinely potentially catastrophic situation. So he turns around and hightails it out of there as quickly as he can. He and his other ship, his consort ship, the Discovery, they do get out of there, but they still follow the ice pack for hundreds of miles westward towards Siberia, towards eastern Russia, trying to see, is there maybe another way into that pack, a much bigger hole, a much bigger passageway. They don't find it. All they find is ice, ice, ice. We now know a lot more ice back then, a lot more ice and thicker ice, stronger ice than there is today.
Well, let's sort of turn to the indigenous people now, because there's a very interesting character on board with Cook, and this, I don't know if I'll get the pronunciation right, but it's Mai. Is that how to pronounce it?
Mai.
Mai. This is one of the things I actually enjoyed so much about your book, is that you spend a lot of time with Mai, and he's a fascinating character. So how come he's on board with Cook? Where does he come from?
So Mai is a Polynesian. He's from Tahiti, from that part of the world, and had been picked up on Cook's second voyage. He had volunteered to come aboard and go all the way to England and sort of become a, it was a curiosity, I guess you would say, but he genuinely wanted to learn about English society. He was a young man. He was about 18, 19, we think, and he became the first Polynesian ever to set foot on English soil, and he lived in England for 2 years, and he became truly a celebrity. He learned English. He hobnobbed with the aristocracy. He learned backgammon and, chess, and he became a good hunter and was popular with the ladies. He would dress up in fancy clothes. I think a lot of the English thought that he came from his own version of aristocracy back in Tahiti, when in fact he was actually a commoner, a very kind of a lowly person in a very stratified society. But he was somebody in terms of, the narrative. For me, he provided a kind of a camera, and it's like he's a camera going through English society of that day. You're seeing it sort of from his point of view. He meets King George. He meets, all the thinkers and writers. He goes to the Royal Society. He meets Samuel Johnson and Boswell. And, another thing, he gets vaccinated for smallpox. and truly, the English rolled out the red carpet for him and treated him quite well, although you can now see also in a very patronizing way. He was kind of held up as an example of the quote-unquote noble savage. But overall, he had a great time. Things went well. He made a lot of friends, and but he was homesick. He wanted to get home back to Tahiti. And King George promised that they would figure out a way to get him back home, which, let's remember, it's the other side of the world. It's 2 years to get him back home of constant voyaging. So that's Cook's third voyage. Yes, Cook is trying to find the Northwest Passage over Canada, but along the way, he is supposed to drop off Mai back home with his considerable now belongings, gifts, animals that he has been given by King George. And so that's a big part of this, of my book, really, is Mai trying to understand why he went to England and what happened to him when he got home. It's unfortunately a pretty tragic story. He becomes, by this point, he's not really English anymore. I mean, he's like part English. He's part Polynesian. He's like a man without a country. He doesn't really belong anywhere. His life experience, his experiences in England have changed him. And he has all these belongings, which the Tahitians don't know what to do about. Like, he's rich now.
Yeah.
But he's still a lowly commoner at the same time. You can't change that. So it's a very, it ends up being, he has a very jumbled existence. But the ulterior motive behind all of this for Mai was that he wanted guns.
Right.
He wanted guns. He wanted to get into a battle with his hated enemies from Bora Bora, who had killed his father and had taken over his native island, Raiatea, which is near Tahiti. And this was all an elaborate long game that he was playing. Like, I'm going to England to learn about guns. And that's exactly what happened. He did get guns and ammunition and all kinds of other weapons. And as soon as Cook left and deposited him on his island, he very shortly thereafter got into a battle with the Bora Borans. And I don't want to tell all of what happens, but it's a bittersweet, it's pretty tragic story of what happens to Mai for the rest of his life.
I always feel he's a bit like a lottery winner, is that you get great wealth, but nobody accepts your new status because they don't accept that just having money is enough. You need to somehow have deserved it, and you just kind of dropped in, and people don't accept it.
Yeah, that's true. It's a society. It was a society that had very clear rules about, you know, where you came from and your genealogy, and you know, there were kings and there were chiefs, and then there were the lowly of the lows, and they knew that that's where he came from, and he could never really overcome that with this new wealth that he had found in England.
And there was another man. He's not on this voyage. It's Tupaia. Mm-hmm. And in some way, he's a more remarkable man than Mai because he is one of the aristocracy.
Yes.
And what I found so interesting about him is that he really gives an idea of the absolutely astonishing navigation skills of the Polynesians. And what they could achieve was just mind-blowing by absolutely any standards, by their standards, by our standards, by the standards of any time. Just incredible.
Not to go too deeply into Tupaia, but he was somebody that Cook had met on his first voyage, I guess. And Tupaia was, he ended up serving as a translator and a kind of ambassador, as is Cook's ship, the Endeavour, went about, you know, from island to island. They, to Cook's astonishment, they figured out that they were all speaking the same language, with minor variations. And this guy, Tupaia, could converse with them. And it began to open up for Cook, certainly on the first and then the second, and certainly by the third, a profound understanding of the extent of the Polynesian diaspora, you know, just how far these people had traveled. And not just drifted, accidentally traveled. I mean, deliberate, planned, well-executed, long-distance voyages repeatedly. Over time. And it would take someone like Cook, who had traversed those same oceans, to understand just how hard that was and how brilliant they must be to pull that off. And their understanding of astronomy, they followed the currents, they followed the migrations of marine mammals and birds. They had all kinds of techniques that they used. And Cook begins to try to assemble some knowledge of, like, how did they do it? How did they pull this off? Because here they are in Easter Island. They're down in New Zealand. They're way up in Hawaii. It's a massive, massive amount of ocean that they traversed in ships that were built without any metal, without any nails, without any rivets. How could they construct ships that could withstand that punishment? How do they remember their way back to their home islands? You know, so many questions emerge. And you see Cook starting to wrestle with these issues. It's like, it's fascinating. You know, we think we're the best mariners. Well, these guys may have even been better and working with far less raw material.
So Tupaia, it's a very unfortunate story. He dies in Batavia of some kind of a fever. But on the voyage itself, on Cook's voyages itself, I mean, I remember reading about previous voyages like Anson's voyage around the world, where almost three quarters of his men die of scurvy. And yet with Cook, I mean, on the voyage itself, hardly anybody succumbs to ill health. So do you just want to say a bit about how Cook manages to handle disease on board?
Yes, I think it's one of the extraordinary things about Cook is that he is very concerned about the welfare of his men, and he is very scientific about how he, you know, approaches the question of hygiene and disease. I think up till then there was this idea that if you're going to go on a long distance voyage, you're going to get scurvy. It's an occupational hazard. Some percentage of the men are going to die of this horrible, horrible malady, because no one really understood what caused it or, you know, how to avoid it. But so they just basically tolerated these numbers of deaths that we would today think is just absurd. But Cook understood, I mean, he certainly didn't understand that it was vitamin C deficiency, but he did understand that there was some connection to fresh food
fresh vegetables, fresh fruits, even fresh meat. And so he was very rigorous about insisting that his men, whenever they were anywhere near an island, that they go out hunting, they go out fishing, they go gather greens, and that they eat this stuff, you know, even if the men didn't think they liked it, you know, salt pork and hardtack biscuits, you know, that diet is no good. You know, you're not getting any kind of vitamins, with that kind of diet. He understood that intuitively. And what's different about Cook is just how rigorous he was in applying the rudimentary ideas that they had at that time. But the upshot is no one on any three of his voyages ever died of scurvy. And these were long, long voyages of 2, 3, 4 years. And so when he got back to England, he was hailed as a hero. Oh, he's conquered scurvy. You know, he hadn't really conquered scurvy. He didn't really understand it. But something about his regiment had, the regimen that he used had indeed saved the lives of his men. And so consequently, he was a hero. And it does say something about him. He was everything about his approach was, you know, methodical and scientific to the extent that there was a science at that time about these things.
You made the point about how he's a strong disciplinarian. It was terribly interesting. There was the incident at Grass Cove where you see Cook sort of at his best. This is the Enlightenment man just peering in from outside, trying to understand and not to judge. And then you have some strange incident at, I'll probably butcher the name, but Morea.
Mm-hmm. Right, Morea.
Where some of his goats get taken. And somehow the disciplinarian in him, he now is imposing his sort of ideas of property on the situation. And could you just sort of talk briefly about what happened at Morea? And because it felt like that was the moment for me anyway, where the character of the voyage slightly changed.
Okay, so most scholars of Cook think that he was a very, very different man on his third voyage, you know, from the first two voyages, in terms of his general tolerance, his leniency. He was very reluctant to apply the lash to his own men during the first two voyages. He was generally very kind and tolerant with the indigenous people that he encountered on the first two voyages. But on the third voyage, something snapped in him. He was an older man. He was perhaps a little less patient. He'd seen a lot. He'd perhaps begun to believe his own celebrity. Others believe that he had something medically wrong with him, perhaps a parasite from all the weird foods he'd been eating that was preventing the absorption of critical vitamins, and that perhaps he had some kind of... I mean, others have said he had essentially like a polar... what do you call it? Bipolar disorder.
Bipolar disorder, something.
I don't know. I don't try to play the doctor that I am not in the book, but I do, there was something different about him. And as the voyage progresses, you see it more and more. Cruelty, just cruelty and hasty decisions and all of it culminating in the incident that you're referring to, Morea. You get to Morea, which is an island right next to Tahiti, and he anchors there, and one of his beloved goats, which was supposed to be destined for Mai was supposed to get this goat. Not only was it a goat, but it was a pregnant goat, and it was stolen. And people from Morea, you know, people from Polynesia, they'd never seen a goat before, and this was a kind of a magical creature, and I guess someone absconded with it. And Cook just snapped, and he goes on a rampage across the island, torching every hut, just destroying villages. They destroy all the canoes they can destroy. I mean, canoes is like the most important possession a Polynesian has. He doesn't kill anybody. He doesn't even, you know, torture anybody or do anything that terrible. But he essentially burns the island and threatens to burn the entire island down if they don't return the goat. He wants the goat. my kingdom for a goat. His men are sort of going, what's going on here? Like, we get it. We want the goat back, but this is crazy. We're making enemies here. We're also greatly outnumbered. Like, if the Moravian people had ever decided to just turn on Cook, they could have overwhelmed him immediately, you know, because they were numerically superior. His men realized this is a different Cook. Something's wrong with the captain. And you begin to see that increasingly in the voyage as we move towards ultimately Hawaii and his fateful demise.
We were talking a little bit about illness and scurvy in particular, but there's another disease which they carry with them, which was, venereal disease, or I guess gonorrhea. I don't know if they had syphilis, but certainly gonorrhea, which they then spread into the islands. And one of the things I can't understand at all is, why are British sailors, who even today are not, you know, the most possessing bunch of, I shouldn't say that, even though they're splendid creatures today, at the time, you kind of wonder what kind of a catch would they be for these women of the islands?
So these men are mostly like 16, 17, 18 years old. They're horny. they're at sea for years. They arrive at these islands, and for some reason, which I cannot fully explain, they are met very enthusiastically, repeatedly from island by island by young Polynesian women who, if you believe the British accounts, and believe me, I'm skeptical at times, like how do we know that it was this, that they were this willing, but the women essentially climb aboard the ship and throw themselves at these stinky, smelly men who probably have horrible breath and haven't bathed in months. Why? I don't understand the attraction there, but apparently it happened throughout the South Seas. It had happened on other voyages. It had happened with Bougainville and his French, the French explorer and his men. And I'm convinced that it's not just something that the officers made up, or it was some fantasy of theirs. It happened. So then you ask the question, sort of an anthropological question, why? Like, what were these young women thinking they could get out of this? In some cases, what they wanted was metal. They wanted nails. Yeah. They wanted anything made of metal. It was an obsession of the Polynesians. And perhaps you could say their men back on shore were demanding that they go get as much metal as you can get. That is a factor, but there's more than that. And what's even more poignant is that a lot of these men, these British men, develop true romantic relationships longer term with some of these women, and try to desert the voyage and go inland and live in paradise with these beautiful women for the rest of their lives. I've written a lot of books about men in hardship and war and expeditions, and my buddies have told me, you ought to think about injecting some sex into your books. You would sell more books if it had some sex, because I never did. It just never really was a theme. Wow, this book has more sex than I know how to process. It's on the beach. It's down in the holds of the ship. It's on the deck of the ship, and it's everywhere. And so it's a theme that I actually had to pare back a lot and just, you know, be very discreet about, because it was everywhere, particularly in the South Seas. But the flip side of all that is that, these men are spreading disease on these islands, and Cook knows it, and he is very distressed about it. He writes about it a lot in his journals, and he prevents anyone who's known to have venereal disease to even go ashore. I mean, he's constantly, it's like a visual I don't want to think about, but he's constantly having his surgeons like strip down the men and check their private parts to see what sores they might have. I mean, I don't even think about it, but it is a theme throughout, especially by the time they get to Hawaii. He's like, he won't even let just over 100 men, they just have to stay on shore while the other men get to go to this paradise and hang out with the locals. So it's a big thing. It's definitely a big theme in the book.
Yeah. And there's another illness on board, which is poor old Captain, is it Clerk?
Yes.
Clark.
I think they pronounce it Clark, or back then they pronounced it Clark. And it's a little confusing, Captain Cook and Captain Clark. But yes, go ahead.
So Captain Clark, he's the captain of, I think it's the Discovery, and he has tuberculosis. And I don't think he knows at the time when he boards that he's got tuberculosis, but he's had some rotten luck because before he gets on board, he's been detained in a debtor's prison. And they think maybe he's caught it there. Although yes. How he then doesn't spread it to the entire crew of his boat, I just don't understand.
I don't understand it either. Tuberculosis is a very strange disease, and there are phases where it's very communicable and other phases where it's not. And back then, they certainly knew a lot about tuberculosis because it was so common and it was so rampant, but they didn't understand the causes of it. They didn't understand exactly when you were contagious and when you weren't. But there were two officers who definitely had it, Clark being one and the other being the surgeon Anderson. And they both had it. And as they moved about these islands in the South Seas, they thought, you know, maybe we should abandon ship and live out the rest of our days, which are numbered, in a nice warm place, because they knew they were heading to Alaska, the cold, foggy Alaska, which would probably kill them. And in fact, it ultimately did kill them. So yes, tuberculosis is another disease that kind of hangs over the voyage, sadly. And, and it was a major killer all over Europe at that time, of course, and all over the world, really.
I like Clark. I think he was an extremely able man, and to be able to keep going, even though, you know, he's suffering so badly with tuberculosis right to the end, it's quite an astonishing act on his part.
Yes, and you know, this third voyage originally was supposed to be captained by Clark. He was supposed to be the captain, and he had always been Captain Cook's. He had always been Captain Cook's number two, and now he's going to be in the limelight. He was going to captain this voyage, and in the last possible minute, Captain Cook takes over, and again, Captain Clark is number two, just kind of always in the shadow of this great Captain Cook. Well, of course, as we all know, Captain Cook does finally, you know, meet his end in Hawaii, and Captain Clark is in charge of the whole voyage. And for the rest of the voyage, you know, he's supposed to be the man, but he is so sick by that point. He is so dreadfully ill that he can't even go, you know, up on deck. So it's a sad kind of thing. He finally gets what he wanted, but he's too sick to do the job.
And perhaps if he would have gotten what he wanted, perhaps both Cook and he would have made it through, because Cook wouldn't have been there and Clark presumably wouldn't have been in the debtor's prison.
Yes, all true. Yeah. There's a lot of little decisions that lead to consequences in these kind of voyages that, you know, that play out sometimes over many weeks and months, but you find out that it's, you know, fairly tragic for some of these men. And this is what I love about this story is that, you know, I don't want people to think that it is just a story about Captain Cook.
Yeah.
I'm not so focused on Cook. Obviously he's the a protagonist, but it is an ensemble story. It is a story of the interactions of all these different men, many of whom wrote beautifully, by the way. I try to use their journals as much as I possibly can. The various officers on board, people like Clark, and there's an amazing man named David Samwell, a Welshman, who was a beautiful writer. There's a young man, you will recognize the name, named William Bly, a young officer who will go on to fame and notoriety, infamy, I should say. He was on board and learned much of what he knew, what we later demonstrated he was a brilliant sailor. He learned it from Cook. Another young officer named Vancouver, George Vancouver, is on board. So I don't know. It's a story of many different people and all their connections. There were 180 people on board these two ships. You know, this is a city on the high seas moving about. Then, of course, there are the indigenous people. And I try as hard as I possibly can to get their perspective on this. What do they think? What do they feel? What? How do they, you know, when these ships arrive at these places like Hawaii, what was their, what on earth did they think was happening and who these men were? So I try to bring that into the story as much as I possibly can.
Do you want to talk about Hawaii? Do you want to talk about Cook as possibly sort of seen as the god Loma, or how do you want to finish this off? Because I don't want to sort of take out, you know, I was going to say the climax to the book, but as you say, the book is not, it is about Cook, but it's about so many different strands and so many different layers. But do you want to just say whatever you want to say about the last days of Captain Cook?
Well, I don't think it's a spoiler to say that, I don't need a spoiler alert to say to your listeners, of course, Captain Cook meets his end in Hawaii. I think everyone kind of knows that. And he has a terribly violent end. I mean, he's essentially hacked to pieces on the beach on the Big Island of Hawaii by Native Hawaiians. And I would say the last quarter of the book is really that story. It tells that story. How did that happen? How did this most disciplined explorer who prided himself on his relations with Polynesians and his understanding of their culture, how did this man who had demonstrated such good judgment so many times on so many islands, how did he end up dead on this beach? And dead, interestingly, in a way, very similar to the man who's often said to be the other greatest explorer of all time, Magellan.
Yeah.
Magellan waded onto the beach in the Philippines, got involved in local politics, and ended up being hacked to pieces on the shores there. And Cook was very well aware of that story, and I think was trying to avoid some kind of story like that for himself, and it happened. So yeah, I tell the story, and I don't right now want to talk too much about the details of his death because it's kind of everything funnels down to that. It kind of like a Greek tragedy, but or Shakespearean tragedy maybe. But anyway, when Cook arrives on the Big Island of Hawaii, a place called Kealakekua Bay, which is a beautiful, beautiful place. He arrives at the height of this festival called the Makahiki, which is a celebration of the god Lono, who was the god of fertility and peace. It was supposed to be a time where you set aside your weapons and you celebrate the harvest, and it's 2-3 months of just endless celebrations and feasting. And he arrived at the height of the festival in this particular manner, this particular direction that the priest had always prophesied that Lono would one day return. He would return from, it's a long story, but the legend was that he'd gone off sort of the edge of the world and would come back one day in a vessel that looked like this with big sails. And here he comes. And these people look very different. They're white skinned. They have very different vessels and implements, and everything about them is very different. And when he comes ashore, he is astonished by the fact that everyone, these thousands and thousands of Hawaiians, prostrate themselves. They bow down to him. They call him Lono. Cook didn't understand who Lono was. They make a path for him, and he moves into the temple, the heiau, where he takes part and becomes the central figure in an elaborate ceremony in which they're calling him Lono and giving him this sort of sacrificial, this sacred food. And whether it was smart on his part or not, good question, but he acquiesced in this. He seemed to go along with it. Well, you know, he probably didn't know whether they were praising him or whether they were going to sacrifice him to the gods eventually, but he takes part in this ritual. And he goes back to his ship, realizing, wow, this is different. He had a lot of effusive and very generous greetings along the way and all of his voyages, but he'd never been treated like that. They seem to treat him as a god. And a lot of anthropologists have argued about that point. Do they really think he was a god, or did they just sort of think he was play acting in part of some larger ritual? These are all good questions, but
certainly something was going on that was very different here. There was a kind of a rapture, just an abandon. It was like Dionysian revelry. The Hawaiians were, you know, they were just so energetic, and they were just, people were crying and shouting and so joyous. So that was the kind of greeting Cook got. And it lasted for several weeks. They kept calling him Lano and treating him like a dignitary at the very least, and probably like a deity. How do things go from that to he ends up being hacked to pieces on the beach? That's the final story that I get into. And it has many components and twists and turns, and there's a lot to unpack there, that's for sure.
Okay, thank you so much for today, and thank you so much for the book. It's terrific, actually. I thought I knew quite a bit about Captain Cook and his voyages, and I just learned, you know, more and more and more. There was more and more depth, and there were more and more layers, and more ways of looking at it, and more, you know, connections. So it was really terrific. So thank you very much.
Well, thank you for the conversation. It's great to be back with you, and have a great day.
Well, that's the end of today's podcast. My thanks again to Hampton, and I really, really recommend his book, The Wide, Wide Sea. It's terrific. So that's it for today. I hope you can join us again for the next episode, which I'm planning to do one on the Byzantine Empire. So I hope you can join for that. And in the meantime, if you can leave a review, that would be absolutely fantastic. I'd really appreciate it. Anyway, goodbye for now, and hope you can join us next time. Bye.